Good evening. If you would, turn to 1 Samuel. Continue our study of the book of Samuel tonight with chapter 8. 8, 9, and 10. So, my notes are a lot, meaning I know I won't get through it, so we're going to do something at the beginning. Okay, so we're going to go over chapter 8, then we're going to go over chapter 9, then we're going to go after chapter 10, and then we're going to get into the lesson. So we can say we covered all three chapters. All right, so here's the summary that I've put together, starting in chapter 8. Okay, 1 through 5, Samuel's sons become judges. Okay, we'll compare Samuel's sons to Eli's sons that we talked about a couple weeks ago, because they also have corruption. People rejects them. Then we get the demand for a king. So this is our intro into the people finally demanding, hey, we're done with the judges. We're wanting something else. We want to look like everyone else. 6 through 9, we see Samuel's disappointment, right? Really, Samuel takes it as they're rejecting me as their leader, as their judge. God gives him that answer, and no, they're rejecting me. Let's go ahead and give them what they want. 10 through 18, Saul warns them about what a king will require of them. And that's after God warns Saul. Warns Samuel. Hey, tell him. Yes, thank you. Okay, I keep saying so. Okay. Samuel warns them about what a king is going to do, right? He's going to take your young men, right? Make them an army. He's going to take your best lands. He's going to take people to work in the vineyard. He's going to tax you, right? All the stuff that we see a king does. So he gives those warnings there and tells it to the people again. Or God tells Samuel. Samuel tells the people. Then verse 19 through 22, Israel says, yeah, we know. We still want a king. Okay, then we get to chapter 9. We get an introduction to Saul. So we get this description of Saul. 3 through 14 gives us the story of how Samuel connects with Saul. Saul's out on a mission by his dad going to look for missing donkeys. So their donkeys have strayed off. He's sent with one of their servants to go look for them. The servant brings up, when they get near to the home or where Samuel was, of, hey, let's go see if the prophet or the seer can help us out. Maybe he can tell us about these donkeys we're looking for. And then 15 through 17, God reveals to Samuel, hey, this is him. He's coming tomorrow. You're going to find who's going to be the king, the first king that I'm going to anoint. Then 18 through 21, Samuel and Saul meet. Samuel compliments Saul. And this compliment we're going to see is one of, you have all the glory of Israel. And all the people are going to desire after you. And of course, Saul doesn't know what that means. He's confused by it. Why would you say something like that? Then 22 through 27, we see a dinner that's taking place, and Saul is sat at the high place of the dinner, and he's given the best cut of meat, whatever that might be, tenderloin for me, something else for you, but reserved for him, okay, as in the best cut for the highest honored guest at the meal. So again, Saul doesn't know what's going on here. He's still confused. And he stays the night. It's the next morning. So when we get to chapter 10. Okay, so next morning, Samuel tells Saul, you're going to be the ruler. It's going to be you. He anoints him with oil. 2 through 13, Samuel is going to deliver to Saul these. Going to prophesy as to what's fixing to come. On your journey back, you're going to meet these three different things. Three different events are going to happen. Two men by Rachel's tomb. They're going to tell you about the donkeys, and you're going to meet three men by a terebinth tree who will give you two loaves of bread. So giving gifts is not normal. Why would they be giving him gifts? So again, something to corroborate the story of what's fixing to happen. And then a group of prophets. You're going to connect with these group of prophets on your way back. When you get close to home, and you, Saul, you're also going to prophesy. Okay, so he's going to see all that. All of this comes true. 14 through 16, His uncle's the kind of the first one in his family to see him. Like, hey, what's going on? Did you see the prophet? Yes, and he told him the truth, right? As in, the donkeys were found. That's what he told us. But he didn't reveal the big news about, I'm going to be your king. 17 through 24, Samuel calls all the people together, proclaims Saul as their new king. We're going to see Saul's nowhere to be found. Okay, so Saul is actually, he's hiding at this point in time. Finally, find him, bring him up front. He's taller, more handsome, looks like a king, right? If you're going to pick a physical king that you want to represent you, you want the big guy, you want the one who's good looking, right? This is our king, and that's really what he is. You see a group of people chanting, long live the king. So support of him. Then you get 25 and 26. Samuel reminds him again, hey, kings are not all they're cracked up to be. You're going to see. And at the end of our text tonight, you're going to see there's some rebels, some guys who don't like the choice. Okay, so think God's made a mistake and they could have done better. So there we go. We're done. We've covered all three chapters. So whoever's next week, you don't have to cover 10. Now let's go to chapter 8 and let's start pulling some points out, some key points. I've identified some that I want to cover. If there's something we skip over in the summary, then by all means, bring it up when we get to the end of that section. Chapter 8, verses 1 through 5. Here we've got a prelude, kind of an intro as to what's happening right before the Israelites are demanding a king. Okay, and we're going to see that, right, Samuel is the last judge over the tribe of Israel. After this, the kings are going to lead the people from this point going forward. Verse 1, you'll see Samuel sets his sons as judges over Israel. Okay, so when we read this, we liken it to Deuteronomy 16, 18 through 20. In that section there, here's what that says. I'll read it real quick. You shall appoint judges and officers in all your gates, which the Lord your God gives you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality, nor take a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. You shall follow what is altogether just, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Okay, so specifically talks about use just judgment, shall not pervert justice, shall not take a bribe. So keep those things in mind, okay? Also, I just want to point out Judges 2 that we talked about last quarter. I think, Joel, when did we do Judges? Two quarters ago. Covered about this, that the judges were called up by God, right? So the judges, the primary main judge over Israel was called up, raised up by God, anointed by God. He was the one that called us. But then there were these sub-judges, I don't know what you want to call them, under them, right, to help delegate the authority and to try to help manage the load. And so that's what we see is happening here with Samuel. Not that he gave up his duties, not that he gave up all of his authority to his sons, but instead they were probably some of these sub-judges to help in certain areas. Okay, so just want to point that out. Now, if you recall, a couple weeks ago when we talked about Eli being the judge, when he was a judge, his sons, chapter 2, verse 12, tells us about his sons, right? Not good guys, okay? Corrupt, says they didn't know the Lord, said they were committing sexual immorality, sleeping with the ladies that were either coming to worship or helping at the temple or at the tabernacle. Not good. So then the very next judge is Samuel, and we have a repeated pattern of sons not following in their father's footsteps. Right? So you've got the Israelites, you've got the tribe getting to a point where, man, the last two judges we've had are bringing in their sons. Their sons are terrible, right? And so does that push them over the edge? You know, does that push them to say, now's the time, we want a king? We're tired of the judges. I don't know. It's just a pattern that we see. We're not told in Scripture this was a thing, but it does come up. You'll see right here in the passage that, hey, you're old, Samuel, is what it says, and your sons, they're not good. So give us a king like all the other nations have. So is it a pattern with the last two? What went wrong with these guys who were good judges in and of that role, in their authority role, but failed their children, or at least failed the sons that were told about? And so I'm not saying Eli and Samuel were bad people, but there's clearly an issue. There's clearly something that's going on here when you have sons who are terrible and don't live up to their father's standards, don't live up to what their father does and even know the Lord, right? Not a good look. Look at verses 4 through 7. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Look, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." So Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them." Okay, so got the elders coming together in 5, Samuel's insulted in 6, verse 7, God says, no, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. All right, the recognition that God knows, hey, they haven't been with me for a while. Right? They haven't recognized me as their leader, and as your leader, and as your king for a while now. And you go back to John's, or whoever's less, Todd's lesson, where we talked about God wasn't with them in the battle against the Philistines. Right? You know, they lost that battle. There's a reason. So what'd they do? What was their next step? Let's go get the ark. You know, if we bring the ark, then maybe he'll be back on our side. Well, they didn't recognize him, right? I mean, the relationship was already severed, right? And that's the roller coaster that we see with all the judges, right? Is that the people fall away, we get a new judge, try to bring them back. People fall away, try to bring them back. People fall away and try to bring them back. And so we're in that valley, or they're in that valley side of things right now. And now skip down and look at 19 and 20. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. This was after he had warned them. Hey, here's what a king does. Here's the burden he's going to put on you. And they said, "No, but we will have a king over us, that we might also be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." So why do they want a king? To look like the other nations. To have someone to judge over us. They already had that. And to have someone to fight our battles for us. Okay, fight our battles. Do what? And they already had that. Okay? That's what God claimed, right? Hey, I'm here to fight your battles. Okay, but let's look at this. Oh, excuse me, behind. 1 Samuel 4. Go to 4 real quick. Let's look at 4 and 6. We covered these already, but here's what I find odd, right? So you look at these reasons, Scripture, they want to be like the other nations. They want to have a king to judge us, and want to have a king to fight our battles. But what I find odd is when we go look at what other nations said about them, 4, 5 through 8. 4, 5 through 8. "And when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted so loudly that the earth shook. Now when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, 'What does the sound of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?' Then they understood that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. So the Philistines were afraid, for they said, 'God has come into the camp.' And they said, 'Woe to us, for such a thing has never happened before. Woe to us, who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness.'" Okay, something similar. Now look at 6, a couple chapters more. Verses 5 and 6. "Therefore, you shall make images of your tumors and images of your rats that ravage the land, and you shall give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from you, from your gods, and from your land. Why then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts when he did mighty things among them, did they not let the people go that they might depart? So what did the Philistines know about the nation of Israel? So they knew, right, what we read in Scripture and say, okay, that's a part of, right, Jewish culture leading into Christianity, right? That's part of our history. No, it's more than that. Other nations in the land knew what happened, right? Factual story, it happened. And so what that leads to right here, what we read in the Philistines, fear. So what we have the nation of the Philistines who know and recognize the king, the leader of the Israelites, is God. Yet we got the group of Israelites who don't even acknowledge that. They've kind of strayed from that, right? They want a physical king. We want a human to rule over us. We want a human to be present and to fight our battles for us. And so I just find it odd that we get those references that the Philistines knew. So I deduct the conclusion that other nations knew as well who their king was and why they didn't have a king, because God is who ruled over them. Any comments in that section before we go on? JR, is your arm, hand up?
It just reminds me of that phrase where he says, you stiff-necked. I don't know that the Jews were any different than anybody else, but he hammered them for that more than once. And this is where it plays out right here again. Even the Philistines knew. Now, they didn't obey God, but they knew.
What else? Any other comments?
You mentioned they wanted a king to judge them, and how is that different? And I don't know the answer, but when you see in a chapter or so, I'm talking about Samuel, it's like there's this guy. There's this holy man we've heard about and the people hold in respect. Like, you don't even see his name. So Samuel didn't have, maybe to us, maybe to me at least, Samuel is very prominent throughout the nation of Israel. And no, he's not a king on a throne, but everybody knows who's God's prophet and everybody listens to him. And it does talk about his fame and people honoring him, but he wasn't a king in that, he wasn't ruling in that way that a king would. And everybody knows this guy's our king and everybody's got to obey him. He was just kind of generally known.
Good point. Anything else on Samuel's rules or his sons and their issues?
Tim. I just think it's interesting. You know, they keep referring to Samuel as an old man. He's not that old. He's still going to live another 40 years. So it sounds to me like they're trying to do whatever they can just to get something going.
Right, right. That is true. Gerald?
I just thank you for pointing out that they had been doing this for a while by all the judges. Because really with Eli and Samuel, when I was like getting ready for one of these earlier chapters, I kind of thought, okay, you know, you end up with two big leaders and their sons don't judge well. And that's what kind of pushed them that direction. I think it's even more true when God tells them, you know, it's not you, they're rejected. It's really not. It's the same pattern they've had. And I think God finally said, okay, I've had enough. There is a point at which he's had enough of our sin, and we better hope that we repent and never get that far ourselves.
And that's...
It kind of speaks to what J.R. just said, that God says they have done all according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods. I don't think they ever put the other gods away truly and truly served God from the beginning.
So then, Jackson.
That the when they mention it's like, well, we want a king to, among the other things, judge over us. What that reads to me is, well, we know what God says, but instead of that, it's almost like itching ears. I want the person in charge of us to be in favor of the things that we know God wouldn't approve of, but this person will, and We want to hear that. We want to feel good about what we're doing.
And so maybe we want somebody to rule over us who has our ear better. As in, I don't know if God, you know, God's going to have his level. If we get some of a man to do it, he's more on our level. Maybe we can match up better and get away with more stuff. But he can see our side, you know, our point of view, because they didn't want to follow. Right? They didn't follow, right? So here's the next question, right? So the people want a king. Is this a departure from God's plan? You know, is this something that wasn't foreseen? Not if we go to Deuteronomy 17. Deuteronomy 17, written estimated 400 years before this. Okay, so 400 years before this, God delivers some of the law. And here's a passage, 14 through 20. And listen to the very beginning of it especially. It points to right now. Starting in verse 14. When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. That's what's happening. Verse 15. You shall surely set a king over you, whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Verse 16. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Okay, point here. Your king shouldn't be doing business with Egypt. We've still got a problem with Egypt. We're not trading with them on anything. 17. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. Also, it shall be, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. So we've got kind of some principles laid out early on of here's how the king should be, right? Absolutely. Everything governing what a king should look like, respectable items, right? You for sure want this, right? Somebody God chooses, don't trade with Egypt. Don't go back to them no matter what. Don't take multiple wives. Don't seek after your own gold and silver. Need to have a copy of the law. You need to have my word in front of you all the time, and you need to be reading it and applying it. Don't think of yourself as better than the other people, than your people. God's plan for a king, very similar to what he wanted of all the judges, of anybody else ruling, or really what he wants of all of us, right? There's nothing special in this list. Yet, we're going to see, you know, as you continue to study all the kings, there's not many that hold up to this standard, unfortunately. John?
It's easy for us to look at how Samuel's sons or Eli's sons were doing things and their corruption and point to it as, oh, look at this. This is the breaking point. But if we look at the history of these people, they've been leaving God since day one. I mean, the one that came to mind to me was, you know, what happened with Gideon in Judges 8. As soon as he died, the people immediately went back to playing the harlot. So deciding to try and push God out of the chair of the king, so to speak, off the throne, that is not some sudden departure of Israel from his law or from how you're supposed to behave. That decision was a fait accompli. It was a done deal based on their behavior. And it's a warning, I think. It's a warning. It was a done deal. It's a warning to us all. that when we make that decision, or someone makes a decision to break like that from God's plan, it's not a sudden thing that just happened. It happens slowly over time, and then bam, all at once, everything changes. And God anticipated that, prepared the way for it, and tried to get people to be good people and follow the law. And what do they do constantly? No, we won't. No, we won't. No, we won't. And that's a cautionary tale, I think, for all of us.
Yeah, we need him. Going back to their perspective, right? We're battling the Philistines. We need him. Right now, we're crawling back. You know, now we want the help, right? And that's what we see. And so John's point, right? These are small steps that get to a big journey, right? It's not one thing happened and they were there. Okay, so you're right. Their faithfulness to God had been failing, right? And that's where I brought it up earlier about they lost that battle. God wasn't with them in that battle because they weren't with God. Anything else in that section? So let me pose this question. Right here, what we got the Israelites rejecting God as their king, rejecting God as their leader, because they wanted to be in favor of, we want a human, we want somebody to be like the other nations, right? Look like we have a king, here's our king, and he's a big, strong guy, and he's going to fight our battles for us, and we're going to look like everyone else. We don't want to look different, because for generations now, they've looked different. But all the other nations knew why they were different, right? But they didn't like looking different. So then you fast forward into the New Testament, right? Is there any parallel between Christ? They rejected Christ when he got here. Did he claim to be a king? He said, I'm your king, right? It's a spiritual kingdom. I'm here. We're going to set up a kingdom. Again, they didn't like the plan, right? That's not what we have in mind. You're not going to overthrow Rome. You're not going to build us a big, great nation that we can go fight. Then you're not what we want. We're rejecting you as our king, right? They do the same thing in the New Testament. Any other thoughts on that? Or am I off base? Correct me if you don't think there's a parallel. Jackson?
Reading recently, that period that you're talking about where when Jesus said, yes, I'm your king, the years prior to that, and it's interesting to see all the different people that cycled through like the physical, the land of Judea and the Jewish people, the people that were over them, the ones that maybe the Romans weren't directly over them, but you know they were tethered in some form. And then the times where the Romans were directly over them and the amount of factions that popped up and, you know, these people like this king, but the other people like this other king. And in the Jews' perspective, how it really should have been, hey, this is, like in this case, this Jesus, he's different. He's not corrupt like these people, or he's not subjugating all these people. He didn't do any violence. He didn't do, you can read 1 Peter 2 and all the things he didn't do that man usually does, and how something that they should have really noticed.
It didn't look like the other nations, Jackson, right? That's what it gets back to, right? Their failure comes down to the comparison of me to the world, them to the other nations, and they wanted to look the same. Any other comments on that section before we go to chapter 9?
I mean, it does seem like, you know, they kind of wanted to go this direction anyway. Samuel's son being corrupt was a convenient excuse. But it seems like what they should have done was go back to God and say, or to Samuel and say, listen, there's corruption here. You're not, you know, these judges we have over us are not obeying God's law. We want somebody over us that is obeying God's law and that will not, you know, take bribes and do all this other stuff that they do, and go back to God with it. And how can you think that if they would have turned to God, that he would have not resolved that somehow, brought another judge, or, you know, rectified it somehow, that was not a king, and it would have brought them closer to God, rather than what they did was take a case of a bad situation and make an even worse situation out of it. Because that's what happened.
They are.
that was the plan. I don't think it was the time for the plan, because now we do have that king who's incorruptible, we can turn to and we can obey when we choose. And he doesn't go away. It just wasn't time for that type of king yet. Probably a lot of others just didn't happen.
So that's what, you know, let's tie that together with Mark's comment, right? That today, what do we do, right? You know, how do we accept the king or reject the king, right? Is it, it's easy for me to look around and point at flaws in other people. You know, what do I need to do, right? Are they as a nation, the Israelites, what do we need to do as a nation, right? Well, that's what you're saying, Mark. What can we do? How do we fix this problem that we have? Not scrap that all. That whole design is bad. God, pretty much, you don't know what you're doing. We want this, like everyone else has. Do we do that today? Do we say, I know Scripture tells me to do this, and I know I should treat this person like this, but you don't know what they did to me. You don't know what they said to me. You don't know whatever excuses we make up, right? I mean, it's the same pattern. We look at them, John, and they've been doing it over and over again. Are we doing the same thing over and over again, right? I mean, what do we have to fix? What do we need to correct to accept the king, not reject the king? Chapter 9, here's the big reveal, okay? So when Samuel's told who this first king will be, so here's our summary of what's going on here, description. So let's go on to the description. Who is Saul? What we see in verse 1, from the tribe of Benjamin. Genesis 49:27 kind of describes Benjamin as a ravenous wolf. What you learn if you study about that tribe, they were warriors. I mean, it talks multiple times, they're good with bows and arrows, they had big armies. But then when we studied Judges a few quarters ago, you remember when the tribe of Benjamin was pretty much wiped out? Remember, they were, there was a dispute. There was a Levite's concubine who was raped and abused all night long and died, and the tribe of Benjamin protected. So we're not going to give up the one who did this or the group that did this. So the other tribe said, all right, we're going to war, and pretty much wiped them out, right? Even to the point where they came together and said, we need to give some females back to the tribe so they can repopulate and regrow the tribe of Benjamin. So at this point in time, what we see, we'll even see comments here from Saul himself. I'm the least of the tribes. I'm coming from no one. Look at verse 21, right? Saul describes his tribes, nothing special. Chapter 9:21. And Saul answered and said, am I not a Benjamite, of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak to me like this? Okay, so what we know here about Benjamin, they're known as one of the smaller ones. They've got some bad past sins, and the other tribes, you know, that thought they were the smallest ones. Who else came out of the tribe of Benjamin in the New Testament? Saul. Right, Saul of Tarsus. Paul was a Benjamite as well. Look at verse 2. More description of who is Saul. Young guy, handsome, taller than everyone else. Right, physically, this is what we want as a king, right? One of our biggest guys, one of our best looking guys. We can put him out there. Now let's look at 6 and 7. What I want to point out here is our starting point of Saul. And what we see as we're introduced to him seems to be a good choice for king. Verses 6 and 7. This is when him and the servant are going to look for the lost donkeys. Okay, and they've decided, the servant has mentioned, hey, Samuel's right over here. Let's go see. Maybe he can help. Verse 6. And he, being the servant, and he said to him, look now, there is in this city a man of God, and he is an honorable man. All that he says surely comes to pass. So let us go there. Perhaps he can show us the way that we should go. Then Saul said to his servant, but look, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread in our vessels is all gone, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have? So here's what I take from that, Saul's point of, hey, if we're going to go before the prophet, we need to take him something. I don't need to just go asking for a favor, asking for something. I want to present something, right? Let's take something. Now look at 19 and 21, 19 through 21. This is when Samuel first meets Saul. Samuel answered Saul and said, "I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today. And tomorrow I will let you go and will tell you all that is in your heart. But as for your donkeys that were lost 3 days ago, do not be anxious about them, for they have been found. And on whom," so here's the quote, "and on whom is all the desire of Israel? Is it not on you and all your father's house?" And Saul answered and said, "Am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak to me like this?" Okay, so I'm no one. Why are you talking to me like this, right? Again, a humble attitude. Now look, flip over to 10, and let's look at 20 through 22. Chapter 10, 20 through 22. "And when Samuel had caused all the tribes of Israel to come near, the tribe of Benjamin was chosen. When he had caused the tribe of Benjamin to come near by their families, the family of Matri was chosen, and Saul the son of Kish was chosen. But when they sought him, he could not be found. Therefore they inquired of the Lord further, 'Has the man come here yet?' And the Lord answered, 'There he is, hidden among the equipment.'" So here's what we got. We've got a couple of instances, or three instances here of this, what I call, what I take from it is humility. Right? If I'm coming before the prophet, coming before the seer, we need to bring him something, right? I'm not better than him. Pride would say, I'm even with Samuel. I'm even with the one at the top running everything. I don't need to bring him anything. And with the second point, you're the one all the tribes favor. You're the one all the tribes. Yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's what a prideful person would say, right? Yeah, I like this. Give me more of that. But he says, no, that's not me. Why are you saying that? That's not me. And then the last point of, you're going to be king, Saul. You're going to be the ruler. Where are you? Come up here. Versus the prideful guy running up first and puffing his chest up saying, yeah, that's me. Right? I want that role. That's me. No, he starts out, what we see multiple passages here, right? God chose a humble king. He chose someone, right, that started out on the right path. Obviously, later we'll talk about the flaws and the things that he runs into later or has issues with. Comments on that section, Wyatt?
It could possibly be imposter syndrome or something, like, because especially with his, me? I'm in the smallest tribe. I'm a literal nobody.
Could be fear in that too, right? But a prideful person doesn't fear anything like this. So these three items that are being pointed out, right? He's going to jump up there right away, right? And so God makes a good choice through what we can see so far, right? About what they might want in a king and what he wants in a king is really what he's looking at. Chapter 10, here it is. We have 2 minutes, right? So there's not a whole lot we're going to cover in here. I do want to point out 25, 26, and 27, right? This is where you've got some rebels, some guys who don't like the choice. Saul's been chosen. It's been announced. This is him. And you got some of the people saying, you know, long live the king. Thank you. We like this choice. Good job. And others from the very beginning, has Saul done anything wrong yet? Has Saul committed a trespass? Have we been told of issues that Saul and his family had with the other? No. So what does that tell us, right? I mean, even within God's plan, there are people who are going to say, your plan's wrong. You made a bad choice, God. Your scriptures that you're laying out for me, that's wrong. I'm not going to follow that. From the very beginning, day one, you had people, yay, thank you, and I'm a dissenter. No, you made a bad choice. And what we're going to see, maybe the next class, there's a group that comes back and wants to kill this group of people. So you'll get that later in a next class. What else is in 10? Anything? God gave the people what they wanted. There is multiple passages in here talk about, or verses 6 and 9, if you look at those, Saul becoming really a changed man. Okay, so the Spirit of the Lord will rush upon you. You'll turn into another man. God changed his heart, is all that it says. Now, this comes at the time where he's leaving, and he's going to prophesy. Right? So there's clearly the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him there to be able to deliver that kind of message and speak like that. Even the people there were like, well, this is Saul. He's not a prophet. When did this happen? Right? So clearly something happened here where God was with him. All right, kids are coming in. That's it for tonight. Thanks, everyone.